board, please. Now, Charlie.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Four Please Now Driving, the official Masters podcast. I'm your host, Marty Smith. We'll be recording all week long here on property at Augusta National Golf Club, discussing the Masters tournament with your favorite celebrities, athletes, and entertainers. This is Wednesday, April 10th. On today's episode, you'll hear from singer-songwriter Niall Horan as he details the real reason behind his infamous tumble down the hill at the 2015 Par 3 contest, as well as his personal relationships with the players. Then we'll chat with famed NBC broadcaster Mike Tirico to learn when he fell in love with the game of golf and what it was like to call history at Augusta National. Finally, I'm joined by media personality Eric Anders Lang to chat about his infatuation with the game and why he actually hated it for so long. So without delay, let's turn off of Washington Road, proceed down the famed Magnolia Lane, and get to it. Here's Niall Horan. Niall Horan is a singer-songwriter, heartthrob, global icon. I'm giving you all kinds of great titles,
this
man.
This is great. Yeah, keep going.
and great friend to the Masters. So thank you so much for joining the official Masters podcast. We appreciate your time so much, man.
No, thanks for having me. I was especially happy when I heard you were doing it. This is great. I was already signed up, and then you definitely kicked it over the line.
Well, thank you.
You're a great man.
I appreciate it. I really enjoyed our time last year, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I just want to start with your passion for the game of golf. Mm-hmm. How did that passion develop? How did you come to love the game so much?
I was always quite like a sporty kid. Like, I was always playing soccer, there was a couple of Irish sports I played, and was kind of a more outdoorsy than sitting watching TV type child. And obviously when I was a kid, Tiger was, as I said to you before, Tiger was like, all you have to do is really is look at the top 10, 20 in the world. They're all my age.
Yeah.
You know, they're all mid-20s, and that, you know, Tiger is the reason, basically. You know, he was changing the game at the time, and he was clearly a dominant part of the game of golf. And when you're young and you're impressionable, it's hard to not want to be like Tiger Woods. So that's where I got it from. My grandmother had I never played golf. I always played like little games of pitch and putt, like small little par three things. And next to my grandmother's house, they had like a local in her neighborhood, like a local little pitch and putt. And I would just go down, jump through a fence with a couple of clubs in my hand, a couple of balls in my pocket, and go and chip until the sun went down type thing. And then when I was about 12 or 13, I joined my local golf club, and then it kind of kicked on from there.
When you were chipping and putting, mm-hmm.
After breaking in the fence, yeah.
What were the dreams? What were you envisioning at that time?
You do all the same stuff, don't you? Like, you want to hold putts at the, you know, chip off green chips with, you know, to win the Open, or to come here and, you know, put for the win at the Masters like every other child did. You know, if you were playing football, you wanted to score a goal in the World Cup final. You know, if you were playing tennis, you wanted to win at Wimbledon. You know, it was kind of like every kind of sport has its little moment, and that's like here and like holding a putt at St. Andrews were kind of golf's ones.
What about the game do you most appreciate?
The older I've got, I appreciate how good the pros are, because I know how hard it is to play myself,
so hard, as
we can both can say there. It's such a meticulous sport, and I appreciate how good these guys and girls are. I like meticulous stuff. I mean, I'm a musician, you know, it's quite a meticulous thing to be able to do. So to play golf is kind of like the sportier version of being a musician, I suppose. And I appreciate how hard it is and how hard you have to work to make yourself good at it.
That's one of the questions that I had for you. How does your profession and your passion for music intersect golf? In what ways are they aligned in your life to create a symbiotic relationship?
Yeah, well, I guess, as I said, how meticulous they both are. Like, if I pick up a guitar to learn something, a riff or a chord progression or whatever, I have to be meticulous. I can't just go up and go, yeah, can do that. You have to spend time with it. I suppose it's the same with everything, but that, you know, being a guitar player or whatever is quite meticulous. Same with golf. You can't just pick it up and swing at it. You know, I mean, if it was that easy, we'd all be pros. But, you know, I think that's where they intersect. And then obviously, you know, I'm friends with a few of the pros who love their music. Like today I was, which blew my mind, by the way, I was on Golf Channel all morning, or for half an hour this morning, and Peter Jacobson was there who I was obviously like, that's Peter Jacobson. But he was telling me, I'd seen him doing something where said he was a guitar player himself. And he said, I really love your album. And started naming like songs. Album tracks off it. And said, you know, that he sits and plays a couple of my songs. And to have that.
How does that feel?
I mean, it's like, I'm even getting goosebumps now. I mean, it's Peter Jacobson, for God's sake. You know, it's just, it's pretty special. And as I said, you know, some of my mates, their love for music and my love for golf is going to pass, you know, like, it's going to cross at some point, you know, the Rosie and Rory and stuff like that. You know, Rosie's hammering me every day to send him songs for my new album. And when he's sitting getting massages or whatever, he'll have a listen to my new stuff, or when he's hitting balls or whatever. It's pretty cool, you know, and that's where we cross, I guess.
I noticed last year you're discussing your relationships with the best players on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
And I noticed last year when we hung out here at Augusta National, we happened upon Jason Day.
That's right, yeah.
He just happened to be on the putting mm-hmm. green, and we walked over, and you guys already had a relationship. Mm-hmm. And that told me a lot. It was obviously a genuine friendship.
Mm-hmm.
How have those relationships with the tour players grown, and how do you foster those relationships?
Yeah, they're great. You know, obviously, I go to quite a lot of tournaments whenever I get a chance, you know, whether it be, you know, I was in Atlanta on tour last year, and a FedEx Tour Championship was on at the same time, so I got down for a day. You bump into the boys on the range. Things like that. And you know, I with Jason Day, you know, his little son is a big fan of mine, and you know, we're best friends, as he
cool
says.
Dad. Yeah, it's cool dad time.
Yeah. And so I kind of, yeah, just kind of see the lads around, and they're just great guys. And it's like, you know, when you haven't seen someone for a while, but they're your friend, and it's just straight back into being friends, even if you haven't seen each other for a long time. But yeah, I suppose I'd be mostly in contact with Rory and Rosie, really, on a daily basis.
Why are you so passionate about growing golf?
I mean, I know what it did for me. You know, it matured me. It, you know, I think it made me a better person in the game. You know, it gave me friends for life, even from when I was a kid and joined the golf club. You know, you don't have to be. I think people have this idea where they feel like they have to be Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. You don't. All you have to do is just pick it up, because I'm telling you, you'll enjoy it. And that is, you know, that's a fact, because you just go out and have a laugh, and you might hit 90 bad shots, but that one shot, that one good one you hit,
you're
straight back, 100%. And there's no better feeling than when you hit that good shot. And it's just good to see kids getting actually out and doing something and being active, you know, in some shape or form. But golf is a great way to get to know people, because you obviously spend a bit of time with them if you're playing golf with them. And I just walking around there today, you know, you see 8-year-olds playing at Augusta National, and there's a potential Masters champion in them. You know, was it 80 people that were here today? There's a good chance of a Masters champion or an Augusta National Women's Amateur champion there as well.
How would you describe the Masters experience?
It's just incredible. It never, ever gets boring, first of all. That drive down Magnolia Lane, walking around the practice facility, just looking out at the place. It's like, it's just golf heaven. And you could just see it on everyone's face. It's the happiest place on earth, basically. It's kind of like the Disneyland of golf. And you can tell that everyone's really happy to be here. And there's just a vibe around the place like no other. You know, we all go to different golf tournaments. We see it. We know what it's like. You know, you watch it on TV. But there's something really special about this place. I was talking to Matt Wallace earlier on, European Tour player. He's won 3 or 4 times in the European Tour. And he'd just gotten his invite. This was his first time. He got here this morning, and he was talking like a 9-year-old. Like, he was so excited, you know. And Sir Nick Faldo was going to take him out, show him the ropes around Augusta National, and he was buzzing off that, like, being here. He couldn't believe, you know, how it looked. The same thing that everyone says. I can't believe how undulating all the courses and stuff like that. He was talking about that, walking around Amen Corner, and I was like, that guy has won multiple European Tour events, and he's excited about this. It doesn't get old, and you can see even when Arnie used to come here, and when Jack turns up here, or Gary Player, they have that look in their eye that they don't have for most of the year, you know.
You just said something that struck me, that drive down Magnolia Lane. You realize, Niall, most of us who come here don't drive down Magnolia Lane.
Very
I've not experienced that, and the vast majority of people listening haven't. What are the emotions for someone who has the opportunity to drive down Magnolia?
You just, you know, you're in a car full of people. The gates open, you get let in, and it feels like the car goes into slow-mo. And you take your time, you roll down the windows, you have a proper look. overhanging trees. You could see the clubhouse with the Augusta logo, Augusta National logo, and that little roundabout in the middle. And you could just feel like the history in it.
The ghosts.
Like, I mean, you could feel them. You could, like, yeah, it's a special one. I wish everyone could do it, but it'd be a congested lane.
To your point, there are so many indelible, memorable moments from the Masters Golf Tournament.
Mm.
What is your moment? What is the moment that you point to and say, that's my moment?
I think for my generation.
I know you're a Tiger guy, man.
Yeah, you know me. I mean, Tiger's chip in on 16. 2005. I mean, it was one of the best moments of all time. Nike got about 10 years marketing.
They did.
Out of it as well. He was just such a dominant force around those years, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. That's when he was at his best. So making moments like that when it mattered, pulling off shots like that, just, he's disgusting, that man. He's unbelievable.
What about his comeback? You talk about miraculous.
Yeah.
He told me last year before this tournament that there was a lengthy period of time when he couldn't even get out of bed.
I mean,
his back, he was in so much pain, he couldn't even lay in the backyard and watch his kids kick a soccer ball around. And now, he's back as a tournament winner, and coming into the 2019 Masters Tournament, there's going to be a lot of eyes looking at that guy's game.
100%. When you're that good, even if you lose it for a bit or you're injured or whatever, I bet he was thriving off the fact that everyone was saying he'll never win again. I bet he was in his head.
Believed.
I bet in his head he was going, good one, watch this. And he didn't just win a regular event.
Yeah.
I mean, he won the Tour Championship. And poor Rosie. Rosie goes and does a season-long thing, wins the FedEx Cup. And there you have 10,000 people going down the fairway at Eastlake.
You ever seen anything like that?
I mean, it was never. The closest thing I've seen to, like...
What did... you're so close with Rory McIlroy.
Mm.
So I had to laugh watching that. His Rory face. Basically looked at Tiger and said, man, this is yours. I'm out.
Yeah.
What has he told you about that moment?
He said he just couldn't believe it. Like, I think what we always think about is Arnie's Army. Mm-hmm. You know, all those famous photos of him walking up the 18 to St. Andrews or walking up the 18 here and the crowd coming in behind him. That was the closest sport, like, golfing moment I've seen to that. And Rory was just like, in Rory's head, he was just like, the reason I play this game is because of this man.
Yep.
And I'm standing next to him. In the final
right
group.
Right now.
In the final group at Eastlake, walking down, and there's, you know, he nearly got trampled on. He was just like, I'm getting out of here before I get killed. He said they were trying to steal, the fans were trying to steal gloves out of their pockets and take the ball out of their pocket. And, like, you know, he said it was a bit chaotic. But I don't think he'll be forgetting that one then.
No.
For a while.
What a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment with that scene is a forever, that's a copyright. That's a forever moment.
You won't be forgetting that one.
Another interesting moment for you, certainly as it pertains to Rory, was 2015. You had the great opportunity to caddy for him in the par 3 contest. What was that experience like?
I was crazy. It was my first Masters. So I arrive up here on I think I might have been here for the practice round on the Tuesday, if I'm not wrong. And then Rory said to me, like, in the weeks coming up to, he's like, do you want to do the par 3 with me? I was like, 100%. Absolutely, yes. And then I got here, put on the boiler suit, and I didn't realize until after, but his caddy at the time, JP, had filled up the bag with, like, tons of these little bottles. There was just loads of these at the bottom of the bag. So I was carrying a full set. He used probably two clubs. I think he used, like, his 58 degree and a putter for the whole nine holes. But it felt like I was carrying the world on my shoulder. Yeah, and then I obviously had that moment where I fell over and live on television, which is not great. I won't be able to live that one down.
You'll never live that down.
No, I was carrying a full weighted bag on one shoulder and pine straw at an angle like that.
That math doesn't work.
Just the physics weren't on my side that day. And yeah, I won't be living that one down for a while. But still didn't take away from the fact that I carried for Rory McIlroy at the par 3 at Augusta.
How did your countless millions, billions of fans react to that moment?
I mean, I've just been taking the mick out of since, like, I everywhere I go, if I go on, like, a TV show, it's brought up. If I do anything sport related
right now,
example here, it always gets brought up. I mean, it was out of my hands. I've tripped over, I fell over, I slid over, slid down a hill with a bag on my shoulders. Nothing I can do about it. It's game over. It's there on YouTube forever, sadly.
I felt like it was pretty graceful.
What do you think?
I got your back, man. It
looks graceful if you put it in slow-mo.
I know, too, that you've used the game for philanthropic endeavors. You mentioned Justin Rose, your friend, and you guys did a gala together.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that come to be and transpire?
We're obviously good friends. You know, I would speak to Rosie most days of the week. We're good mates. And we were just like, how do we want to do a charity event? And straight away, the first thing that came to mind was we need to give to a cancer research of some sort, charity. And, you know, Rosie had lost his dad to cancer. His wife, you know, had lost her parent also. He's got kids, first of all. You know, we all know. My uncle died of cancer. My granny died of cancer. There's, you know, we all sadly know someone that's died of cancer. And that just seems like the right place to go. So we went with Cancer Research UK Kids and Teens. Because that's where it seems to hit home more when you see kids. Like, I do a lot of work, you know, where I do meet and greets and go to hospitals and stuff like that. And you to watch like a 6-year-old child sitting there, you know, with cancer is just horrendous. So we decided that we were going to do that. And the way we bring music and golf together is pretty cool on the night itself. You know, we had a perform two, we've done it twice now, and we do it every second year. We had a performer, I performed this year, you know, Rosie gets up, and this year he had Mo Farah, the British runner, and Seb Coe, who is the, you know, the head of the Olympic Committee for the British. Rosie winning the Olympics, you know, they had like a bit of a talk, and we do a big auction where obviously we were able, because of the golf world and because of the music world and how strong they are, we can get some amazing auction prizes. So over the last couple of years, we've raised like $2 million on from the night. And when I look at it, it's the least we can do. There's obviously a lot of preparation that goes into it, and there's, you know, hands-on for everyone. We literally just turn up in the night, put a suit on, get up and sing a few songs, sit there as Rosie does this talk, and we raise a lot of money. And thank God that we can do it in that fashion, because it's an amazing feeling after when you look at the figures we've raised.
I know that when you perform every night, you get to see a legion of people who adore you and what you do.
Mm.
But I can't imagine there's a greater feeling of fulfillment in that night at that gala with that impact.
Yeah, for both of us. You know, as I said, it's a great charity. And actually, Justin's sister had worked a lot with Cancer Research UK as well. So it was an easy one for us to pick. But yeah, there's nothing better, you know, than hearing where the money goes, knowing where it goes, first of all. Because that's a lot of time with people with charity. You know, they donate loads of money, but they don't think it's going to get there at the right spots. But this is they're notorious for doing the right things with their money that's donated, and it was just a great feeling. Like, there's nothing better. Like, you can win as many PGA Tour events as you want. You can get up, as you say, win awards, play to whatever. It's something special about it.
How many places on earth can you go and walk freely and take it in and not be, I don't want to use the word bothered, but not be bothered?
Yeah, fair enough.
I imagine Augusta National must be one of the very, very few.
That's my favorite thing. Where the ban cell phones here, and you're not to bring your cell phone on property. Not me, not anyone, not the members. No one's allowed their phone on site. And that's great, because I can just walk around then. And, you know, people will come up and say hello, but there's no, you know, and we can have a chat or whatever.
That's wonderful.
Which I prefer.
Right, sure.
You know, because everyone wants a photo or an autograph. You know, which is fair enough, but it's nice to actually stand around and watch golf and talk to people about golf. And yeah, this place is special for a few reasons. That's one of them.
I always say one of the greatest things about Augusta National is you are truly immersed in the tournament.
100%.
And you're present in the moment, because you're not looking at it through that iPhone lens.
Yeah, exactly.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I try and do that at my concerts as well. I try and get people to stick their phones in their pockets, because memories, you know, are for life, and pictures are for when your
Instagram.
Memory card, Instagram, and when your memory card goes, that's the picture's gone. Just you have the memories then. So it's just a special place, and I hope they keep. As I said, I hope they keep inviting me back, because I like it here.
Last thing, and I'll let you run.
Mm-hmm.
That little guy hitting those chips after breaking through that fence, as we've discussed. To have enjoyed the professional career you've had and the iconic brand you've built that allows you these folks to want you to be here as an ambassador of something you grew up dreaming about, what would that guy chipping those balls say about this guy that's sitting right here right now?
He'd be laughing at him. He wouldn't believe it was going to happen. Just like, yeah, it's crazy. Like, I'm a complete self-confessed golf nut. And there's no better place to be a golf nut than Augusta National. So when you get invited here, it's just the greatest feeling in the world. And to see, to be an ambassador for Drive, Chip and Putt, and potentially now with the Augusta National Women's Amateur, they're changing the game here at Augusta, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Thank you for being a part of
this. Part of your legend. Thanks very much, Pat. Appreciate it.
Niles' appreciation for the game of golf and desire to grow it is so palpable when you chat with him about it. He lights up when he's discussing not only playing the game, but growing the game. You could hear it with what he said about the young ladies who played in the inaugural Augusta National Women's Amateur. What he said about how passionate he is about the drive, chip, and putt contest. What he says about those relationships he's built with several players, including Justin Rose, and of course, Rory McIlroy. I find it hilarious that that golf bag back in 2015 was full of waters. And Niall, just a quick word. I know you're listening to this. That's what real friends do. They set out to put you in those types of positions. Speaking of great friends, it was such an honor and a joy to spend time with my great friend, NBC's Mike Tirico, chatting about his Masters experience. He's been coming to Augusta National since 1997, one of the most notable, iconic Masters of all time. It was also wonderful to discuss with him calling the first ever Augusta National Women's Amateur Tournament and what he'll be doing during the weekend. He'll be in a perch at the 18th green calling the Masters for Westwood One Radio. Tirico has a lot going on. Here's my conversation with him, NBC broadcaster Mike Tirico. Mike, let's just start. You've had the most distinguished career. You've had the opportunity to cover World Cups and Olympics and Monday Night Football for a decade with ESPN and all of these wonderful experiences. Where does the Masters rank, and what differentiates the Masters?
I'm getting old. I've been to a lot of this. This is on and off now, 22 years that I've been coming here. So I'll just take you back in my personal history for 10 seconds, not to bore folks too much. But I got the opportunity to start covering golf for ABC in 1997. And at that time, I was still working at ESPN, and they thought because of my connection with the PGA Tour, now covering golf, it would be a great natural extension to have me be part of our Sports Center coverage at the majors, which started with our coverage here at the Masters. And that was also the year that Tiger Woods had that win for the ages.
That was
Jim
important.
Nance has described it. Yeah, so 97 was more than a good year to get started on my time in the game and my time coming to Augusta National. And it never gets old. It really never gets old. And you've watched the area, the golf course evolve and change. And yet, as a lot of the settings around here change, they don't completely change. They adjust. They evolve. They evolved to fit the time. Who would have thought 10 years ago, let alone 97, we'd be sitting here doing a Masters podcast?
Amen.
But one thing I think is an external misconception of Augusta National that I had until I got here and learned the history of the place, learned what the founders of Augusta National really wanted from the club and the tournament. This place has evolved. The golf course has evolved. It's very different from when it started. Essentially, 13 and 15 are still those dramatic holes. 12 and 16 have the drama, the short par threes that are world-renowned. But things have changed and evolved over time, and the Masters has stayed with currency as the preeminent event in this sport, and you'd put it up with any other sporting event in the entire world. So I love coming back and now have a little history to have watched that evolution firsthand.
It is not easy to evolve the way that Augusta National has and the Masters Tournament has and maintain spirit.
Right.
They've managed to maintain spirit from beginning until present.
Yes.
How would you describe that challenge?
Best tournament for the players. That was part of the early charge of Bobby Jones. I mean, Clifford Roberts and Bobby Jones co-founded Augusta National. It was some of that. And then when the patrons were here, it was give them the best possible experience. And I always tell people, you know, we all get asked when we're lucky enough to come here all the time, hey, first timer, what should I do? How should I do this? I would say, take $20 and go get a sandwich and some chips and a beer and get it for you and the person you're with. And you're going to come back with change.
Yep.
And I can guarantee you there are about 75% of the sporting venues that you can get just the beer alone or the beverage alone.
Get a hot dog.
A hot dog. And you're not coming back with a lot of change of that 20, especially if you do it for two. And it's just the greatest experience. And it's for the players inside the ropes, for the patrons outside the ropes, for anyone, for us in the media. This media center that we're sitting in.
It's state of the art.
I told folks when I came through there the first time, I said, I think you should have every sporting event, just the cameras routed to Augusta National's Media Center. And we have all this AI and all this stuff we can do with 3D glasses and this whole bit. Let's just artificially put a hologram of the people after their games right up there on the desk. And let's just cover every sporting event here. Because this media building is the finest in the world. I'm not saying it because I'm here. And I think, Marty, we talked about this before we got started. People say that a lot. You know, why do you say these things about Augusta National? Because when you experience it, it's the truth. It's hard to get here. As a player, as someone to play the game, as a guest, as a member of the media. But when you get here, I challenge you to find any place in the world where you are treated better.
You noted 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable moment in the history of this wonderful tournament. What was the impact of that moment?
You know, I think a lot of us thought the impact for the moment was going to be changing the face of golf, and we'd see more minorities in the game. I think what it truly did to the game of golf, it made golf cool. It brought guys who were football players, basketball players, to say, you know, hey, you could be the biggest star in sports if you're a golfer. In this day and age, in the day and age of the end of the Michael Jordan championship run, number one had come, and now he was starting run number two right in the middle of it, 96, 97, 98, with the Bulls. And you had somebody who had come out of nowhere with all this hype of winning all these amateur championships and three in a row U.S. AMs after the consecutive junior AMs. And he arrived, Tiger, on the scene. And what he did here by just blasting past the field with all the expectations, it sent a message that you could be the biggest star in sports in golf. And I think that's why we've seen a physical evolution of the players who are the best players in the world now. The height of the average golfer. I remember when I first came out here on tour in 97, you can kind of look a few guys in the eye. Now, Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka, I'm like, hey, don't, you know.
They're grown men.
Don't tackle me now. You know. So you're seeing guys who have played basketball or football, baseball, great athletes coming to golf. It's not that all golfers in the past weren't good athletes, just those elite athletes who had other options to be high-level, high-end performers were coming to golf. And we got my mom, my grandma, the guy who never watches golf to come to the TV because there was this special athlete with a very unique backstory who didn't look like the rest of the other golfers who were out there doing incredible things. And if that, in fact, helped you bump into, my gosh, Phil Mickelson's incredible, or this player or that player became your favorite, then that was good. So I think that was a shot in the arm and a boost for the game, which needed it at the time. But I think on the long arc of history, what we didn't see when we left here in April of 97 was that Tiger was going to make golf cool and bring a lot better athlete to the game.
Was that the moment for you, 97? What's the Masters for you?
My Masters moment is still Jack because it was a time when I had grown up around the four major sports of football, basketball, baseball, hockey. I grew up in New York City, so I didn't have the necessary exposure to college sports that I would gain as I went to college at Syracuse later on in my time. But golf had just been introduced to me a little bit by my uncle, who was a father figure to me growing up, and he loved the game. And he was a big Nicklaus guy, and he interlocked his grip because of Nicklaus and all that stuff. You put out of a crouch and look at it kind of one eye and do all that. And that Jack Sunday charge was one of those that I think was reminiscent of what a lot of us thought Tiger last year was going to be. When Tiger made the run, had the lead at the Open, didn't close, Molinari wins, had a chance at the PGA. Those moments were a lot of us who have kids who are now somewhere in that 15 to 25 mm-hmm. neighborhood, we were saying, hey, you need to watch this because this is what it was like. And you're going to have a chance one more time to see the greatest of your era, perhaps all time, win one of the biggest tournaments. And for me, Jack in 86 was that. I tangentially remember as a teenager, Jack winning at Baltus Raw a little bit later in his career and adding to his major titles. But Jack in 86, here I was now, soon to be 18 years old, and I'm going to remember that. I knew the legacy and the allure of Nicholas. To watch it and watch it happen at Augusta, to me, that is still my moment because it was that moment that I fell in love with golf. And I said, wow, this is really, really cool and something special.
One last thing about Tiger. A lot of people are going to be looking at him this week mm-hmm. as a player to beat. What percentage chance would you have given a couple of years ago that that sentence would be uttered?
So I thought if he ever played well again, that this would be the place he would have the best chance at winning here and at the Open, depending on which course in the road of the Open was being played at. And I thought that because I think more than any other major championship, local knowledge pays you so many dividends at Augusta National. As long as you can hit it a prerequisite at a distance, we saw Fred Couples, while still not playing a big, deep volume of great golf because of his back injuries, Freddie'd come in here and he'd shoot a really good round. And there were more times than not that we'd find Freddie in Butler Cabin on Friday afternoon talking about having a chance to succeed if his back could hold up. So I thought if Tiger got back to enough healthy golf that he could compete, that this would be the main place.
Do you think he would?
Did I think he would? There was a time I didn't. There was a time I thought he was done. I think there was a time all of us thought he was done.
He did.
Yeah, exactly.
He did.
Right, exactly. And there was no reason to believe that there was any sign the golf game was coming back. But once we started to see it come back, I said, I don't think he's going to win another major. And if he does, it would be Augusta. And obviously, with how close he came at the Open and the PGA, we think differently. I think the biggest hurdle after he's healthy enough to play, he's healthy enough to compete. I think the biggest hurdle is now depth of field. I think more
That's
guys...
That's his own fault.
In
most
many ways.
Of these guys are playing because of his influence.
In many ways, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and they also... I think we're also in a separate almost answer, but there's a different generation of athlete. I don't think athletes today fear settings or opponents the way they did in the 60s or 70s. Let me go way off to right field here. When you used to hear that the Boston Celtics had Game 7 at Boston Garden,
book it.
It was this mystical deal mm-hmm. of you don't see it all the time on TV. The parquet floor is, and I'm talking 60s, 70s now, the parquet floor has these dead spots. There's no hot water in the visitor's dressing room. All these mystical things. Now, there are no arenas left like that in sport. There are very few home field advantages like that. And if there are, you've seen them all. If you're an aspiring athlete in any sport, you have observed the career of every athlete because of the proliferation of what we're doing right now.
That's right.
Conversations. When you sit down, I haven't sat down with Nick Saban very often since he's been at Alabama, but I feel like when you guys go down and talk to him with your college football coverage, I feel like I kind of know how Nick Saban thinks and talks and feels. And there are very few secrets now in sports. And I think all of that has taken the intimidation factor out. So in addition to the deeper fields, I think the guys who get in contention, they know Tiger's there. But instead of saying, oh, no, Tiger's on the leaderboard, I'm checking out, they want to have the one time in their life to say, Tiger was right there and I beat him.
I'm going
to
go beat him.
Like Brooks Koepka can say that forever. Tiger was playing. He was playing really good. And he won a major championship that he was in. So I think that's changed it and made it a lot tougher. Having said all that, I still think that he knows he's got maybe, what, 3-5 Masters left. And most of what he does, while he'd love to win the U.S. Open again or the PGA or whatever,
That's right.
Here, first full week in April, let's go.
Very rarely do we get, you know, you were talking about there not being a whole lot of secrets anymore. It's not every day anymore in sport either where we truly watch history occur right now mm-hmm. in the present. You got to see that with the Augusta National Women's Amateur.
Yeah.
What an amazing finish. What an amazing moment, not only for this tournament, for these grounds, but for golf.
No doubt.
How would you describe the impact?
Marty, I don't think we knew what to expect because, first off, you have to keep reminding everyone, It is amateur golf. You've watched the U.S. amateur for the boys, the young men that are playing. And you know that's a notch below the PGA Tour golf or the major championship golf that we see. It's very good golf, but it's a notch below. And if you watch golf, you have to understand there's going to be a notch down from what you see in women's professional golf to women's amateur golf. Then put a times 10 factor like this on it. Of the 30 women who made the cut of the 72 who started, 20 are still in college.
Unbelievable.
So you're kind of talking about watching people play at the level of the NCAA basketball tournament that's going on usually around Masters time compared to NBA players. And now you're talking about players who have no experience here at Augusta National. And we just talked about what's one of the big reasons Tiger could still win here. It's the experience. It's the local knowledge. And then you have the fear factor of the intimidation that's out there of being the first group to play here and make a great impression for this event. So I think you had all those things lined up. So I didn't know what we'd see. And of all the scenarios, I thought, I didn't expect 10 under.
Unreal.
I didn't expect 5 under 67 for the winner. I didn't expect 32 on the second nine. I didn't expect that stretch of holes that we saw the eventual winner, Jennifer Kupcho from Wake Forest, play 5 under the last 6 holes. I never expected any of that. And to be here and see it was so cool. And I'll tell you the reasons it was cool. One, competition, which at the end of the day, I know you're kind of wired like me. I don't care what sport it is.
No.
If somebody's keeping score and people are competing, I kind of like to watch and root for somebody, right? So you got that. Let's forget that it's Augusta National, a place that you only see true competition 4 days a year. And now we're being given a bonus. We're being given a fifth day of competition on the most famous second nine in the world. And then on top of that, if you're of a certain age, I'm a dad who has a daughter who plays high school golf. Now, she's not going to play at a high competitive level going forward, but she plays and is competitive with her team and enjoys playing. And to see a role model for her of what golf can be, or more importantly and more appropriately for the younger girls who are 12, 13, 14, to say, hey, I can really go places in this sport as an amateur during my college days, even if I don't turn pro. What a bunch of wows altogether. And you talk about narratives changing in 1 week, in one event, and almost really one day, a lot changed with that event.
Absolutely. And the narrative began when it was announced.
Yes.
It was a landmark announcement when, for the entirety of these grounds, you said it, 4 days. And now you add that fifth. How did you react?
I was surprised. Usually when the chairman of Augusta National holds that press conference that happens the week of the Masters on Wednesday, usually it's the typical issues that you might expect, the hot button issues in the game. Over a variety of years, we could pretty much forecast what was going to be said. But when Chairman Fred Ridley, at the first address that he had in that role, announced this event, it was, wow.
A lot of eyebrows went up.
And what it did, as we went back historically and looked, really opened my eyes to two things. And it's going to come back to one of the first things you said, Marty, about this place. And that's the deep roots to the traditions of Augusta National. Amateur tournament here. Bobby Jones is the greatest amateur golfer who ever lived. And he stayed amateur, and that has inspired many, many folks who were good amateurs to stay amateurs during their career. So now you're having an amateur tournament here. Jones would love that. And because of past news and past history, people immediately just blanched at a women's event being held here. But when you look back at Jones, Bobby Jones was inspired by and guided in many ways by some of the top women amateurs of his time. Some of his quotes, some of his stories, some of the credit he gives for becoming a more calm golfer on the golf course. Some of the history of the work that was done with Alistair McKenzie for finishing this golf course traced back to some of the significant women of the 20s and 30s who were involved in amateur golf when the numbers were not very plentiful. But certainly those who were very significant. So when you really peel back this onion a little bit, this event has a lot of core values that trace right back to the most influential person at Augusta National, and that's Jones. So you start to understand all that, and you go, maybe this makes sense. And this place has the loudest megaphone, the broadest platform to be seen in sports. And if Augusta National can do it, other clubs can do it.
A couple more things, and I'll let you run. So you're going to be in the 18th Tower, right?
I will be actually doing radio
For Westwood,
for the first time for Westwood One in their 18th Tower.
That's wonderful.
And I am so excited about all that.
What do you expect the challenge to be to paint a picture on radio for the listeners from your vantage point there at 18?
Well, I'm excited about it. I haven't done that before for golf. I've done a lot of stuff for golf. I have not called it on the radio. And that's going to be a blast. And also for me to be sitting at 18, because on TV coverage over the years, whether I've been in Butler Cabin on Thursday, Friday, or watching on our set getting ready to go on the air, I have not seen all those shots coming to 18. Now I'm going to get to sit there with Charlie Reimer and call the action on radio and watch it all play out. So as a kid, I'm really excited about that. But I also know this, the proximity is so close to the 18th green, that's why you whisper.
Right.
So it's going to be one of those traditional.
Have you been practicing your golf voice?
Here's the putt at 18 to win. So that's going to be me, and that's okay. That's fine. But I'm so excited to do it because I still think sports on the radio has this transformative quality to it.
Completely agree.
You're working out, you're walking, you're listening, you're in a car. Most of it, I think, happens in a car. And it could be complete background noise, or you can get lost in the description of what's going on. And that's up to the consumer, but it's up to the broadcaster with a complete blank canvas to paint the picture for you. There is no better place to use as a canvas than Augusta National.
It's a pretty good one.
It's a darn good one. So that is going to be fun, and I'm really excited to do something I've never done before in my career. At this advanced age for me, the chance to do that is pretty cool.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time and insight. I'm so humbled by everything that you just said and all that you know and your wonderful book of knowledge of this event and having been here for more than two decades.
Wow. Keep that quiet.
I know. I promise I won't tell anybody else except for everybody listening.
I'm trying to age as gracefully as you're going to, but I will say this. For the people who have never been to Augusta National, when you hear a lot of us in very reverent terms talk about Augusta National, the simplest thing I can say is if you get golf, then you get Augusta National. And the chance to come here may take someone who doesn't get either one and turns them around to a believer. And I just spoke to someone who came here for the first time Saturday for the Augusta National Women's Amateur, and they got done. They said they were exhausted, but they understand now why we all talk about this place like this. I'm so glad that more and more people have the opportunity. And I hope if you're listening, if you ever have the chance to be here, keep sending in that lottery. One year, it's going to be your time. And when you do, it'll be worth every second of the wait.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, man. Great to see you, Marty.
So
keep up the great work, buddy.
I always enjoy Mike's perspective on anything sport and life for that matter. But his resume is so impressive. You heard what we said there. He's called everything that's anything in the world of sport, whether that's World Cup soccer, whether that's the Olympics, and certainly all of these years as a integral part of the media core for the Masters Tournament here at Augusta National. I love his perspective on everything sport. Now let's move over to my conversation with Eric Anders Lang, who only recently has fallen in love with golf, and boy, did he fall hard. It's interesting what we get into in this conversation about why it took him so long to find the game. And oh yeah, he also got to play Augusta National 1 year ago when he won the media lottery. Here's my conversation with Eric Anders Lang.
You knew to golf. I understand.
Relatively.
Took it up at 30.
My life is so enveloped in golf that I don't feel new to the game, but yes, only been playing for about 20-something percent of my life.
20% of your life. Okay, so how have you improved during that time? Is this a dramatic improvement, or are you like the rest of us and go out there and hit it all over the reservation and pray?
I mean, I think improvement is a difficult way to measure golf as you sort of grow up with the game, however, whenever you start it. I think that I still have the capacity to hit as many bad shots, and I still have the capacity to hit as many good shots. I think it's kind of, for me, the best way to measure improvement is in just sort of, you know, when you watch a pro hit a bad shot, they sort of just take it and then they move on. And I think that's a great standard by which amateurs could potentially play the game, knowing that maybe they're good enough to get out of any situation. So I'm not, but I like to think that dealing with the difficult shots is probably something I'd like to be great at.
What made you take up the game at 30?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question because I actually didn't like golf up until 29. And the sad part about that is I didn't know anything about golf. I didn't even understand it. But it was my brother, who's 10 years older than me. He sort of was the Eskimo, right? Like kept asking me to play with him throughout his entire life and his childhood. And I was always like, no, I'm not a golfer. And then I don't really know exactly what changed, but it was one day. He said, do you want to play golf with me and dad? And I said, no. And then it was like a weird like moment where I was like, why am I saying no? I don't even know what this game is about.
Was it pride?
Interesting. I've never looked at it that way. You know, my brother and I had a lot of differences of opinion.
It was pride.
So it may have been that I'm right and he's wrong. Maybe. In the end, he was right.
So now that you're infatuated with it, addicted to it, what's beautiful about golf?
Well, right there, right? We talk about how did I get into the game. Last year, I was here as a credentialed member of the media, one of the proudest moments in my career and my personal life, able to bring my brother through the media center.
Oh, man. How'd he react?
It was heavy. It was heavy because when I first found out about Augusta National and the Masters, I remember I didn't understand it. I didn't understand what a major was. I didn't understand that Augusta was special or that the Masters was special because it's the same place every year. And when I told him that I wanted to play Augusta National, you know, 7 years ago, he laughed. And it was really interesting to be here with him. And just, you almost get emotional thinking about it. And I don't even know why.
Well, you don't, anyone who's been here once or 35 times, talk to Jim Nance about this. The reaction emotionally will strike you. You might not even expect it after several years the way that it hits you, especially the first time, and especially when there's that bond that you've now built with a family member, someone like your brother, and when you can offer a gift that is impossible to buy, it is that much more special. So it doesn't surprise me that you had those emotions and that he had those emotions and that it was heavy. I can relate. I brought my wife's uncle here. I'd never been to the Masters. I was the same as you, man. I came in 2015 for the first time. I didn't play golf. I didn't consume golf. I wasn't especially into the game. I'm a stick and ball guy in, you know, hoops and football and whatnot. And I was so taken with the atmosphere and the majesty and how pristine everything is and the kindness in the air that is extremely foreign outside these gates. We don't have that level of empathy for one another that you carry here. And I was taken by all that. And he cried.
Really?
So he's this voracious golf consumer. He goes on all these trips with his boys and, you know, they do that whole 72 over 4 days and drink beers and raise hell. And that's wonderful, but it's very foreign to me.
It could happen to you though.
It will. I mean, I'm inching my way there, but to see his reaction and the desire to walk and experience each hole that the ghosts still walk was a fascinating, viscerally palpable thing, even for me, especially for him.
You know, we were just walking up number one here, and this isn't my idea. Alexander, my friend from Golf Channel, Alexander Laughlin, told me the way she perceived the Masters. Because we were talking about how the tournament basically lives inside you and you rebuild it every year. So the first time I came to Augusta and the Masters, I'll be honest, it didn't blow me away, but I didn't know enough about it at the time. So in the 4 years that have passed since that first trip here, it means more and more to me every year, to the point where when I go through the gate, a place that meant nothing to me at one point in my life, negative nothing, now means more and more. And I know next year it'll mean more and the year after it'll mean more. And when I'm 60, I can't imagine how much it'll mean to me. And Alexander was saying that in some sense, the Masters, more than any other sporting event, perhaps, is closer to a holiday in the sense that
family reunion, man.
It's family reunion. There's tradition. And what do you do together with those traditions and that time? You basically, and this is not a knock, but you don't do anything. You just exist together and watch the story unfold each year in a different way. I couldn't think of a better way to put it.
And you were immersed in that story. Whereas everywhere else in our lives, we're immersed elsewhere.
No phones.
We're distracted by technology and by all of the minutiae around us with that technology. Here, you are willingly forced to fellowship with one another, look one another in the eye, listen. Doesn't happen very many places, man. Not anymore.
Well, yeah, when you watch any golf tournament or most sporting events on TV, the action gets close to the crowd. All you really see is flashes and cell phones. And what's cool here is when you walk around, you actually talk to people because people are available to be spoken to. And that is, it takes a couple minutes to get used to.
I love
it. It's pleasant.
I think it's wonderful. I think we could all learn a big lesson from that from a larger perspective. But so you win the media lottery last year, I learned. Earlier this morning. So you've actually played here.
I believe that's true.
What was that like? You birdied one?
Yeah.
Who are you, man?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, birdying one is the hardest thing for me to do in a round of golf, but we can get into that later. You get into hopes real quick. I'm already one under. I could shoot 500 today. My lowest round is 2 over. I mean, what's it like? It's the more time away from it, now we're almost at 358 days since, right? I've kind of got like a clock.
You don't have a running tally,
yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. The further away I get from it, the more special it becomes. And
why?
The more it feels like a dream. Well, memories are strange, right? You don't remember what actually happened. You remember what you feel like happened.
That's right.
You know, we are designed to remember being burned more than we are to remember getting a good grade. And that's because, biologically speaking, we shouldn't get burned. And so the memory of playing Augusta National the Monday after the Masters will continue to sadly degrade for me, and I won't remember it the way it actually happened. So I wrote down all the notes and I recorded everything I could in the moment. But yeah, I mean, it's ultimately that rare experience that we have in life that something's actually very beautiful and very sad. And there's a strange thing when you walk off of a very special round that you've been looking forward to for a while, that you have to deal with the fact that it's over now.
Isn't that the beauty of nostalgia, though? You just summarize nostalgia in that it's beautiful and sad simultaneously. I seek nostalgia. I want to feel that emotion. I want to feel that sensation. I try to find it, whether it's like a song or it's a moment or whatnot. And certainly that striated film strip of our memory that you're discussing. It's phenomenal. You're going to be telling your grandkids you shot 6 under, man.
And then I walked on the first tee. You're right. I mean, and I think to sum it up in maybe a different way is that the wonderful part of being able to play here is that I was given an opportunity to educate my own experience of this, whatever it is, the Masters or Augusta. I don't know how you differentiate the two, because for most people it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
For a very few it's different. But that wonderful educational opportunity of learning about the game, how it's played and how it's thought of, and how as a single or as a group, how we think of golf. I mean, that is such a privilege to have been given through luck, I believe, the opportunity to see that firsthand and to, you know, have to deal with all of those feelings. I mean, try sleeping the night before. That Sunday night was not asleep. I didn't sleep.
I can't imagine. I mean, it's phenomenal. So since you played here, that means you got to drive down Magnolia Lane, something most of us can only see in our dreams. What's it like when you actually do it?
It's honestly, I was very nervous. Strangely, I remember very specifically, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know, because that was the beginning of the roller coaster. You're on Washington Boulevard, or is it Washington Road?
Road.
Doesn't matter. You're just on Washington Road.
Yeah.
You're in a parking lot waiting for your time to go through the gate. That doesn't matter. But once you take a right, in my case, and you are admitted on the grounds and you begin going down Washington Road, that is when the roller coaster goes click, click, click. And you realize that there is, well, you're not going to turn back, but there's no slowing it down at that point. I was listening to James Brown on the road, and it was raining that morning, and I remember listening to James Brown, and it fit perfectly, obviously born in Augusta. And I turned the music down to meet with the security guard, and then as I started to go down Magnolia Lane, I remember I turned the music off, because I was like, was already too much.
Roll the windows down?
Yeah. I rolled the windows down. Yeah, yeah, I have to. And I got a little distracted because I could see the driving range on the left, which you don't get to see. Because as a golf geek, you want to know those things too. But, I mean, yeah, and then you're just perpetually at that point, you're just wanting to experience all of it as slowly as possible. You want the food to come out slower.
What are the colors like? What's the air like?
Well, that was a perfect day, right? Because as a photographer by trade, color is best on a cloudy day. And so I was lucky enough to have a day with mist and cloud. So it was very rich and dense. And the only thing you really see on Magnolia Lane is the yellow floral logo. You know, you see that. But most of the day was filled with just intense green. Everywhere you look. I mean, there's a little brown, a little gray, but it was mostly just this shades of green that just kind of, you know, there's billions, I'm sure.
Where else have you been, either professionally or personally, that had the spirit that this place carries? Because despite the evolution of the property, and there's been dramatic evolution, both of the tournament itself and the grounds here, the spirit has maintained. The spirit lives on from its actual inception until this very moment you and I are sitting here. That's a challenge. How would you describe that spirit?
Ooh, that's a tough question. How would I describe the spirit of the attention?
Air. It's the air. Like, how do you describe the air here?
Well, the tricky part about that is that, you know, we as, you know, human golfers, right? We basically want, I think, to get in as natural as we can, right? We want to play golf in places that are extraordinarily beautiful naturally to the eye. And the trick is, though, is that golf courses are not entirely natural, especially Augusta, right? I mean, it was built. Mm-hmm. And so the wonderful deception is that as you stand here and as you marvel at the spirit, you are basically fooled and you forget that there was, you know, when it's done perfectly, you forget that there was a man mm-hmm. that showed up. And when it's really, really done perfectly, you look out on Earth and you almost are probably going to laugh at what you're doing with a club in your hand. I think that's the goal, right? And when it's really, really done right. But it's very rare. It's very, very rare. In fact, I was originally, when you asked me to compare it, my thoughts went to Alaska. I've never played golf in Alaska. I've never stepped on foot on a golf course in Alaska, but I've been to, you know, Mount Denali. You know, I've been fly fishing up there. That's kind of where I went. That specific day with the atmosphere and the ribbons of, like, Georgia unfolding, it's like that's like you don't see it.
It's interesting. So basically what you're saying is the only place that can capture where the aesthetics meet the spirit is true natural wonder.
One of the things that's interesting about some of the spots on the course, there is, aside from grass that's been manicured in a specific way and stones and a pin, there is no evidence of mankind. And that, to me, I find very beautiful because there's something about, it goes back to like Walden or something, you know, like you want to be completely isolated in nature. And that's something that I look for in a great golf course. As well, when you're done with the round, you want to hang out with your buddies in a nice clubhouse, which we have here as well.
No question. Yeah. A lot of people said Grand Canyon.
Interesting.
Yeah. A lot of people felt like the wonder of the Grand Canyon was the only thing that they had experienced that rivals this.
Oh, I can't wait to listen to all the other interviews you've done.
There are so many indelible moments in the history of this tournament, certainly. What's your moment? What's the indelible moment for you?
I look at Oosthuizen's albatross. I think that, to me, that has multiple aspects to it. First, it was the first albatross on that hole. It was the first two on two. I'm not a numerologist. I think the other thing about Oosthuizen's, too, was that it's not – no one is expecting that. Like, you're expecting maybe to hit the green and make a putt. And whereas on a par three, you're kind of looking at a hole-in-one, you know? I mean, and so you can't really do any better than a two on a par five. It's not really humanly possible. And so to me, that one sticks out. Also, I really like Oosthuizen. I think he's got a great – he's a role model both in the way he lives his life, and I love his golf swing. That's a big thing for me.
What about the way he lives his life inspires you?
I guess – not knowing all the facts about his life, what I will say is, in the brief interactions I've had with him, these people are very busy as professional athletes. He's given me the time of day. And that goes a long way because I've gotten the other side of it, which I'm sure ultimately is a factor of being pulled in thousands, literally, of directions at a professional event. And so I just know, while I said, again, not knowing, you know, what his day-to-day life is actually like, but knowing that he saw me as a person when he didn't have to, that meant a lot to me.
Absolutely. All we want is to feel welcome and wanted. That's what we want as humans. That's the human element, right?
Yeah.
If someone had never been here and was coming here, what do you tell them?
I mean, I think the only thing you can really say is, and it's sort of, I think the only thing you can really say is just take a deep breath and smile and just say, enjoy it. Because you will never, ever get to experience it for the first time again. And that's kind of what I was getting at earlier about playing here, is like you can't do that again. And so there's a lot of moments in life that you will never get to relive. Fortunately, some of them we are prepared. Some of them we aren't.
That one you're not. No matter what your expectations are, it exceeds it.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to encapsulate what it is with words. You have to see.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating. Thanks for your perspective, brother.
Thank you.
It's very welcome. I appreciate it. I wish you guys could have seen his reaction when I asked him if it was pride, simple pride, why he didn't fall in love with golf sooner. It struck him, and his reaction to that struck me. His passion for the game is obvious. It's infectious. It's fun to see how wide-eyed he still is about the Masters experience. I can relate because I'm still every bit as wide-eyed as he is. Many of you can relate to that same emotion, especially those of you who have come to the Masters and Augusta National in person yourselves. There is absolutely nothing in the world like it. Thanks so much for listening to Four Please Now Driving, the official Masters podcast. Again, we're doing this every night during the tournament throughout the week until Sunday evening when someone puts a green jacket on his back. Good night from Augusta National Golf Club.